Welcome along to the Go Play Soccer podcast with host Manchester United Academy coach Tom Statham. At Go Play, our aim is to bring people together from all across the world to discuss the beautiful game.
Tom Statham here, and for this episode of the Go Play Soccer podcast, we're trying something different. John O'Sullivan from Changing the Game Project asked me and my friend and mentor Tony Whelan to be guests on the Way of Champions podcast. We all had a good time recording the conversation and decided to release it on the Go Play Soccer podcast too. I hope you enjoy it as much as we did.
Tom and Tony, welcome to the Way of Champions. Tom, welcome back. And Tony, it's been many years. I've known you and I've been wanting to get you on the podcast here. So excited to have you on, my friend.
Well, thanks for the kind invitation. I'm delighted I can be here and join you and talk together.
Yeah, well, this is great. And Tom, welcome back. I was looking back and it's actually been quite a few years since we had you on and lots to talk about. But, you know, you and I still stay in touch and, you know, flash an email back and forth and everything. So welcome back, my friend.
Oh, it's a pleasure. And I was on like one of your, I think I was episode 39. I don't know what you're up to.
I was going
to
say you were probably year one and we're at about 250 right now. So,
wow.
So I don't know. I haven't missed a week here for 250 weeks. So that's pretty good here so far. Amazing. So it's good. Well, hey, let's just do this. Maybe Tony, I'll start with you to just give a little bit of background of your role in coaching and your time at Manchester United since you're new to the podcast. And then Tom, I'll let you give your bio again. But Tony, you can start like talk about your playing days and then your role in coaching for these last couple decades.
How far do you want me to go back? I mean,
this could take the whole.
It's only an hour long podcast.
I signed for Manchester United when I was 14 years of age, as what they call a schoolboy form, an associated schoolboy form. So I was a talented schoolboy footballer, and most of your football in those days, back in the 60s, was played at school. So and you couldn't play for a professional club until you left school. So I signed what they call Associated Schoolboy Forms, which entitled me to go and train a couple of nights a week at Man United. And at the weekends, I played for my school team or my junior club on a Sunday. And that was pretty much my football growing up. And then when I was 16, I left school, 15 when I left school. I signed what they call apprenticeship, a two-year apprentice contract. And then that led into me starting professional in 1969, December 1969, a professional. And I was at Manchester United for about five seasons through to about 1973. And then I spent two seasons at Manchester City. Long story. Long story. I went over there for a couple of years. Then I played for a small club in Lancashire called Rochdale for about three seasons. And during that time, I went along to a team in Los Angeles. And Los Angeles Skyhawks in America, in California. And I think the sunshine gripped me. So I ended up, they were in the ASL, what was the American Soccer League. And the coach there, Ron Newman, God rest his soul, a wonderful person. I might talk about him a little bit later. He then, the following season, got a job in Fort Lauderdale for the Fort Lauderdale Strikers. And that's when I went. I went out there in 1977 and spent about five seasons in Fort Lauderdale with the Strikers, and amazing times, some wonderful players there at the time. George Best was there, Gerd Muller was there. It was amazing. And then I spent a couple of years in Atlanta, the Atlanta Chiefs, in the NASL. And then I played indoors for a season, for a winter. Still recovering from that, Philadelphia.
I was going to say your body must still be recovering.
I'm still recovering from it. Went to Philadelphia for a winter. Went to places like Boston, playing indoors, and Buffalo. It's just, I mean, January, February. I mean, you just couldn't even move. And then I came back to the UK for the summer of '82, and did some coaching qualifications here in the UK. And then I went back to Fort Lauderdale for a season to be a player and also director of youth development, because I'd done quite a lot of work originally at the time. When you sign contracts back in the day, there's an obligation to do some coaching. That's where I first got to coaching, when I was in Fort Lauderdale, doing clinics in schools and local community groups and so on and so forth. So, and then I came back to England The NASL was on its last legs, it's on its knees, and I came back to the UK. And I spent about 15 years in social work, going to social work through the back door, a long story. It's another podcast. Mm-hmm. So I ended up sort of doing social work. And it was during that time that I started coaching at Manchester United part-time. Brian Kidd, who I'd played with in Fort Lauderdale, I think he'd seen me do some work there on the coaching side. And he invited me to join what it was called the Centre of Excellence in those days in 1990. And I've been at the club ever since in various capacities. So,
through head of academy coaching to assistant academy manager, academy advisor, so many things. I remember when I visited, Tom took me out to Carrington and I met you for the first time. And I just was watching you work and you were going from sort of session to session, talking to the kids, connecting with them. And Tom, you told me at that time, you said what a great mentor Tony was to you. And I could see it just in his connection to those kids, how important that was. Because you think about the pressure on a young child that's trying to make it at Manchester United, to have someone there in the Man United gear who's like this human being, caring about them as a person, so important, right, Tom?
Absolutely. And Tony's been very modest about his playing career as well, because we're recording this in Tony's house. And I've just been looking at all of his pictures there he's got with Pelé and George Best and all the likes that he's played with. It's just fantastic. So his playing career was pretty good. But you're right. For me, he's been a mentor and someone that's helped and guided me for the last, I'm getting on for 30 years really, because as Tony mentioned, he started at Manchester United in 1990 part-time, and you were still doing the social work then, weren't you? Part-time, yeah. And I was, luckily, I got involved in 1994, and we were part-time together. Paul McGuinness, who was a friend of mine from the university and that was in charge of the Centre of Excellence at the time, he was the only full-time member of staff. And me and Tony worked with Paul part-time, and so I was in my mid-20s at that point. So to have someone like Tony to look up to and to help settle me into the club. He taught me about the culture of the club. He taught me the traditions, because I'm not from Manchester. So, you know, he really made me aware of what a special club it was and how privileged we were to be working and to be coaching at such a club. So that was fantastic. And great memories that I have after the sessions at the Cliff, which is the old training ground, iconic. And there was a couple of bats. I don't know that, but at the end of the sessions, there was a couple of bats that used to face each other. And so we'd be there having a bath, just chatting football. So for me as a young coach, you know, I was 26 at the time when I started. So to have Tony telling stories about what he'd done and you know, about the club, and we were working with guys like Eric Harrison and Jimmy Ryan and Pop Robson and obviously Paul as well. You know, it's just the most incredible first sort of 2, 3, 4 years of my coaching career. And he's been there for me ever since. So it's just, you know, very, very important person in my whole career, really.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's interesting. And we were talking before we started, and Tony, you said your role kind of now is connecting, kind of like you did for Tom, connecting people to the history and the tradition of the club. And I know a guy named Owen Eastwood, and he worked with Gareth Southgate and the England set up this year. And he just came out with a book. It's called Belonging. And it's about, and he does work with sports teams all over the world, connecting the current athlete to, he's a New Zealander, connecting them to the tradition and the history and talking about, in this moment where you wear the shirt, right, you leave the shirt in a better place. And this is your moment in time when the sun shines upon you. That's sort of this Maori tradition. But all these people came before you and all these people will come after you. And it sounds like that really resonates with you, that is your role, isn't it?
Well, I think you put it ever so well. Yeah, very succinctly. Yeah, that's it, really, in a nutshell, because I was privileged and honoured as a young player to serve under Sir Matt Busby, who was an absolute legend of football in the UK. around the world. You know, he founded and established or re-established the youth policy back in the 50s, and was a manager, of course, when during the Munich disaster. And his assistant Jimmy Murphy was his coach. So, and I grew up in and around those people. And Wolf McGuinness, who was Paul's dad, mentioned Paul McGuinness, his dad. And so I grew up in the 60s at Manchester United, when it was just a joyous place to be. You know, you were told to just go and enjoy football. The coaching wasn't overly complicated. Pass it to somebody in a red shirt, basically. Make sure you pass it to somebody in a red shirt. I mean, it's basic.
Yeah.
But enjoy your football. Express yourself. Be creative. Be yourself. Be true to yourself. Be true to your nature. And that was what I was brought up with. So, you know, when I came back into coaching, you know, many, many years later, I just applied it or reapplied it in a different situation, in a different era, a different context, because those people connected with you. You know, they're very personal people. You know, Matt Busby and Jimmy Murphy, and certainly Wolf McGuinness, who was my first coach when I came to the club. I mean, you go into the gym with the cliff, the iconic cliff, or the sacred cliff, as we call it, and he'd be, you know, this 32-year-old guy when I was about 14, 15, and he'd be doing diving headers and overhead kicks. And he'd be charging around the gym if he scored a goal, like as if he'd won the World Cup. And I'm going, wow, who is this guy? You know, it was inspirational. Just a wonderful human being, warm, friendly, joyous, the whole football, the whole atmosphere was fantastic. And that's why I grew up on. And that's why I wanted to sort of make sure when I came back to the club, I remembered all that. And I just wanted it to be like that, because I thought if I could just make the young players feel as good as I felt, I couldn't wait to go to train. I had to get two buses. I live sort of in South Manchester, and the cliff was in North Manchester. I'd have to get two buses to school in the morning, because I went to school sort of quite far away, another story. So I get two, on a Tuesday and Thursday, two buses to school, and then two buses to the cliff, one into Manchester city centre, and then one out again. And then late at night, I get another bus into Manchester, and then get home at 10 o'clock at night. Mm. Having left the house at 7:30 in the morning, you know, but never thought anything of it. It was just, I just couldn't wait to go and train. Mm. And basically that was my diet, my upbringing as a young player, playing for my school team, playing for my junior club on a Sunday, training at Man United twice a week, if possible, sometimes only once a week because I was playing for the school team or something like that. And I got 16 years in the professional game out of that training. Mm. And I look at what's going on today sometimes in youth football and wonder, where's childhood? Where's it sitting on? Because I had a wonderful childhood just playing football and enjoying it. And I wasn't overcoached. In fact, people would argue I got undercoached. But then you
compare that, Tony, like there's never any chance of you getting burnout, was there? Because physically and mentally you were stimulated all the time.
The only burnout I get is the travel on the buses.
Yeah.
But in terms of football, there'd be no burnout.
Yeah,
zero burnout. I mean, I need to name check some people here because they're just, you know, flooding through my mind. I went to a dinner. We've got an All Boys Association, Manchester United All Boys Association. We had a dinner about 3 or 4 weeks ago, and I invited my former school football teacher to the dinner. He's 84. I'm sitting having dinner with him, and I said to him, I said, here's the deal. I said, I'm not calling you Kevin. I'm calling you Mr. Lyons or Sir, because I've got too much respect for you. So you decide, what's it going to be? Because there's no way I'm going to call you Kevin. Because he's saying, call me Kevin. I said, I can't do it. I've got too much respect for you. So then I get to thinking about why was that then? Why is that? Why can't I call this guy by his first name all these years later? I mean, you talk about 50 years ago now.
Yeah,
I left school in 1968. Why is it all these years later I can't call this guy Kevin by his first name? Because he was just a wonderful human being, and he taught science, by the way. Now, I hadn't got a clue about science then or now, but he took the football team, and he took the. But he gave you some responsibility. He gave you little jobs. He was teaching you to be a leader before the word leadership was ever invented. Because he'd give you little tasks to do, go and, you know, round the boys up, get them in the dressing room before the game, you know, make sure they get to the bus stop on time, make sure they get to where we were playing on time, getting little jobs, not just me, but other boys as well. And he was a referee. He actually got off on referee. That's what he was, a referee. So he wasn't really interested in doing any coaching, which was great because you just got on with it and played. He'd ask you questions afterwards or half time, but he never really, you know, sort of overemphasized the coaching. He just wanted to make sure that he played football, that he enjoyed it, and you were disciplined and you you respected the game.
Yeah.
And you respected the opponents and you respected the school team, you know, and be proud of it and all of that. And that's the values that I've tried to hand down, you know, over the years. And there was another guy called Malcolm Wright, who's sadly deceased now. He was like the PE teacher at the school. And he was like, wanted to be a proper coach.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Wright wanted to be a proper coach. And we used to say to him, he used to give us sort of sessions, you know, the traditional coaching sessions that we have now. And I always remember him doing that. And used to say to him, sir, come on, can't we just play football now? Mm-hmm. And he got it. He said, oh, okay. So every week on a Monday or a Tuesday when you had PE, you'd say, okay, Mr. Wright, can we just do that stuff that you do? Can we just do it for 10 minutes and start playing football?
Yeah.
And he got it. And because he got it, we were in love with him, you know. Yeah. And so those are the people I've got. And then I had a guy called Mr. Sherwood who took my Sunday league team. And he was like a portly guy, smoked cigarettes. And if you were playing an away game, you'd have a little sort of saloon car. You'd have about 20 of you in the car, right? And the first job was when you got to the corner shop, go and get him his 20 Piccadilly cigarettes. And he'd stand on the sideline smoking. And, you know, go and play, go and enjoy it. And then that's what it was like. That's what I grew up in.
Well let me jump in, because this is, I mean, you just said go and play, go and enjoy it.
Yeah.
And I think this is the key. And I think, you know, I mean, Tom, you and I have talked about this so many times that joy has to be at the center of it. And still, you know, I can watch you speaking, Tony. We're on video here, obviously, and I see the light in your eyes. Like, your eyes are shining because of these memories of joy of football. And Tom, you said, you know, there's rarely burnout when there's joy, right? And so, Tom, like, talk about that for a second. Like, what, you know, joy, I know, is at the center of your coaching too. And, you know, you're working with, you know, real young kids who are just trying to get into the academy and stuff. And I mean, talk about joy.
Yeah, well, you can hear, you're quite right. You can hear how important it is to Tony. And you know, I said before, I was in my mid-20s just starting to coach. So when you're spending a lot of time with a guy like this, who's telling you about Mr. Lyons and telling you about all these stories constantly, then it has a massive effect on you. So I believe that the role that Tony's played, that hopefully I've played over a long period of time at Manchester United, is exactly that. It's creating the environment. It's creating the space where kids can turn up and they know that they're going to have a great time. You know, when they see Tony, the kids turn up and they see me, and they just think they're the guys that are just going to let us do what we want to do and what we love most, and that's play football. And we're not going to hit them with a lot of complicated scientific practices. We're not going to use a lot of terminology that they don't understand. We're going to have a good laugh with them. We're going to, you know, give them a few jokes, sing a few songs, make sure that they're having a brilliant time. And from that, that's how they develop their love of the game. That's how they develop as footballers, and they want to keep coming back. And people take it so seriously, don't they? And they think that you have to treat young kids like mini adults, and they're just not. Young kids are exactly that. You know, I work with 8, 9, 10, 11-year-old kids at Manchester United, and you've got to treat them that way. So you've got to connect with them at that level. You've got to make them laugh. You've got to make them feel comfortable. And if you do that and let them play lots of football, then amazingly, they'll just flourish. And, you know, the number of kids that, I mean, I run the podcast, Go Play Soccer podcast that I have. And I've had people, you know, like Fraser Campbell, that's still playing at Huddersfield, but played for Manchester United. And David Jones and people like that. And they all mention Tony because they all mention the fact that he created that place where they could turn up, play football, and just absolutely love it. And that sustains them. So when times get difficult, you know, you're not playing well. You know, you are playing professional football and it's a tough world. And maybe you're not in the team or you're not playing well or you've got a contract dispute or you're injured or there's so many things that are difficult in the world of professional football. It's not all, you know, great times and big money and glamour. So when the times are hard, you need that love of the game. You need that the joy of the game in order to get you through it. The problem is that so many coaches, they feel that they've got to be, you know, proper coaches or adults with the kids. And it just knocks the love of the game out of them. So they get to 13, 14. And rather that being a time when they're kicking on and really, you know, looking to progress in the game, is that they've fallen out of love of the game and they don't want to do it anymore.
It's professionalization. I would call premature professionalism, which is the main problem. It's like a virus, I think.
Yeah.
Let me give you an example, right? So it's 1968, right? And Man United are in the European Cup final on the 29th of May, right? They win their first European Cup, right? 2 weeks before that, I think it's a Tuesday night, the 14th of May, 1968, Stretford Schoolboys are playing Middleton Schoolboys at Old Trafford, right? At Old Trafford on the main ground, right? Uh-huh. And I was playing for the town team. I was the captain, right? And I can't remember feeling any stress whatsoever. Mm-hmm. Just go out and play, enjoy it. You're never going to play at Old Trafford again, might never play at Old Trafford again. And I've still got the program.
Yeah.
I've still got, so I can prove it, right? Not long ago, I was at a junior, I was at Trafford, the local club, and a guy came over to me, tapped me on the shoulder, a guy called Steve Mason, who I played with in that game.
No way.
Honestly, I mean, just before the pandemic.
Yeah.
Steve Mason went to Stoke, had a bit of a career. And so we get chatting away, and he says, "Oh," he said, "remember when we played at Old Trafford?" "Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. I've still got the program." "What?" "What?" "Yeah." So he gave me the program. He gave me the program. But then we get talking about that particular period of time, and it was the same thing that Tom's talking about. We were talking about Mr. Lyons, a guy called Mr. Ford, who was like the secretary of the school's football association. Right. Mm. And one of the things I remember most from my schoolboy days was that I think my school had played their school, St. Paul's. I went to a school called St. Paul's. We played Old Trafford. And I think it was the last schoolboy game I ever played with. And he came up to me after the game and said to me, "Tony," he said, you brought me so much joy when I've seen you, even though you've been playing against us, the way that you play, you've given me so much joy in football." I'm thinking, what? I've never forgotten that. That's the atmosphere that I was brought up in, where in those days there were very few adults around. So you get Mr. Lyons, for example, I used to live quite a way away from school, so after games I'd get a lift. I'd give me a lift halfway home or put me on the bus or something like that, because very few parents, people didn't have cars in those days, so parents didn't go. So if we had one guy, Mr. Crampton, who had a Bedford van, and everybody wanted to get in his van because it was a big van, and he had a big hat on, big woolly hat on, Mr. Crampton. His son was a good player, Gary, but he wanted to get in his van because he was just such fun. He'd be all over the road, and he wouldn't be thinking about playing football or thinking about what tactics you're going to do. It's like, what's he going to do next? And then you get to the ground, and you think, oh, God, we got here, okay. And then you go and play, right? And you'd be standing on the sideline, Alan Sherwood, with his smoking cigarettes. And, like, you'd go a goal down and you'd be going, nobody was shouting or bawling at you.
Yeah.
None of that. So, and that's what I grew up with. And of course, as you said before, that's something that I've tried to hand down.
Yeah.
It's the people that... I'm thinking to myself, that all I've done, say, with Tom and others, is handed that down. So when I've done that, I'm respecting those people. I'm remembering them. So, Mr. Lyons and Mr. Wright, they live on. Their career, I said to him, "Your career's not over yet, because I'm still around. Your career will be finished when we're all gone." Mm-hmm. Because that's, we're just handing down what you gave us. It's obviously in a different context, but it's now 2021. It's not 1966. But the principles are the same. And for me, it's summarizing, I'd use probably the best way to describe it, but protecting childhood, because they protected my childhood big time.
Yeah. Big time. Let me ask this. How do you balance, especially in today's world, protecting childhood and that joy and instilling love, which you both know I am 100% aligned with. And then I think we have academy coaches, and this isn't just a football problem. This is across all sports, feeling the pressure of we need to win, or, you know, we need to push that, we need to develop this pro. And so this isn't about joy. This is about seriousness and getting better. How do you protect childhood in that environment? Because it's definitely gotten harder, hasn't it?
Well, I think it's educating people that feel that they've got to get the way to progress children is by treating them like professionals. It's to educate those coaches and say, actually, the harder that you try and the more pressure that you put under and the more professional your approach is, the less chance they've got of succeeding. And the more that you make your role about supporting and caring for and loving and nurturing those kids, the more you concentrate on that aspect, the more chance they've got of progressing. Because actually, the football or whatever sport it is, it looks after itself, like Tony was saying earlier. When can we play? When can we just play, you know, stop messing about with all this other stuff? And it's very easy. Football's a very easy game. So if you're doing practices that don't really look like the game of football, then you're not going right. So make your practices very simple, make them very game-based, and then just encourage the kids just to take part, give them lots of encouragement, give them lots of support, give them lots of love, make them laugh, make them feel comfortable. They make a mistake, it's not a problem. So when they arrive, like I say, I want the kids to arrive and look over at people like Tony and myself and think, brilliant, they're here. It's all, everything's going to be fine. Everything's going to be okay. I can relax and I can play and do what I love to do most.
Yeah.
You know what? And I'll let you go, Tony. What you just said, Tom, what we've just been talking about, in my mind, should be the first thing that you learn when you walk into a coaching course. And it's often never even mentioned.
Yeah. Well, I always say when in the coaching courses, when do they talk about what jokes you need to make a 10-year-old laugh? You know, that's what you need. You know, I've got loads of stupid jokes. So the kids say it because they're playing. They at the end of the session, they go, "Oh, we finished." I went, "No, I'm English. I don't come from Finland." You know, and just have stupid things like that, that just to make them groan and laugh. And that's what you need. You need to just to have a good time with them.
John, I think it's more important to be a good life coach. Too many people want to be soccer coaches or swimming coaches or athletic coaches. Where for me, it's a high calling to be a life coach. And if you don't, and by that I mean that you're teaching young players about life through football, right? That's part of the process too. And I think, you know, early on, right at the beginning of the podcast, I think you used the word connecting with young people. Mm-hmm. Well, I think that is the task for the coach right from the word go. And I think in a lot of cases, it seems to me, anyway, my experience, they're putting football first and the connecting comes second. Mm-hmm. And they've got it the long way around. If you can connect with young people and you can create the sort of environments where they can thrive, And environments that are conducive to learning, and you can invite and they are stress free, they are fear, they're non threatening. Then you've got a chance of developing people in any, if they've got any ability at all, whether it's academic ability, whether it's sporting ability, whether it's music, whether it's dance, whatever it is, you've got a chance, haven't you? I would have thought.
But even if they want to be the best coaches, Tom, like you think. The two greatest coaches or managers in the history of Manchester United, Sir Matt Busby and Sir Alex Ferguson.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And what are their greatest qualities?
People person.
Yeah. So Matt Busby and Sir Alex Ferguson weren't great because they knew the game of football so much better than everyone else in the world.
No.
Because there's only so much you can know about football. But what made them great is what you just said.
Yeah. Understood people. And obviously, amazing managers. Understood people, understood human nature. And the more you understand about human nature, and you know, the better coach you want to be. So I mean, I learned many, many years ago to be, you know, I got to thinking about rather than being top down, what can I give the players? What about looking at the other way? What can I learn from the players? And when I say that, by observing, by watching how they react to certain sessions, what sort of feedback you're getting from these sessions? Mm-hmm. You know, look at the feedback. What sort of feedback am I getting from this? Because the feedback ain't great. Maybe you might want to change something.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? So I'm not saying that the animals should run the zoo, but I think you've got to be sensitive to making sure that what you're giving the young player is appropriate and that they're enjoying it. Because if they are, they're going to work hard anyway. You know, I think young people, you know, certainly footballers, they love the, as Tom said, they love the game, they love football, why are they playing it? And it's as basic as that. And our job really is to make sure that they retain that love of the game. You know, when they pass through us, that's our job. That they when they leave us, they still love the game. And if somebody's going to mess it up,
mm-hmm.
and somebody's going to do something that's going to make them fall out of love of the game, hopefully it's not going to be me.
Mm.
Because that's a big, big burden to bear. I wouldn't want to bear that burden of thinking some kids falling out of love of the game because of, you know, the work that I've given, the sessions that I've given them, the environment that I've created hasn't been a wholesome, healthy, happy place to be.
Yeah. Well, because I think you hit the hit the nail on the head here with this idea that if I connect first, right, then, you know, I think that the greatest quality of a coach is to have your players understand he's in it for me. She's in it for me, right? If I know, and this is your teachers in school as well. If I know that they are in it for me, for my best interest, yeah. Then when they push me, then when they demand more, then when they hold me accountable, even though I might not like it in the moment, I understand why it's happening, yeah. Right? But if this person is just about the football, just about the techniques, the technical piece, just about science or history, and they don't care about me, then I don't really care, right? I mean, I think that Teddy wrote, no one cares what you know till they know that you care. I mean, I think if every coach knew and lived that,
yeah,
you'd be much better off, wouldn't you?
Oh, well, Mr. Lyons didn't teach me any science. I mean, he tried.
Yeah, he tried.
Tried like hell. Didn't work. But I tell you what, he created the sort of environment where I could thrive in and around his company when I was playing football. Yeah. And I treasure that. I do treasure that. It's wonderful. It's wonderful.
What about, Tom, what about the idea of patience? Now, you both have seen so many players come through from 8, 9, 10, 11, and make it to the first team of Manchester United. I think, Tom, you know, one of the first kids you worked with young was Wes Brown, and I had Wes on the podcast a couple months ago, and you know, he talked about his time, you know, in that locker room as an academy player there and on to win a Champions League. Talk about the role of patience as a coach working with children to not, you know, to see what they could be and not just see where they are today.
Yeah, I think one of the things that's important to realize is that it's not linear progress. So it varies. So some kids will peak when they're 8 years old and they'll be the best player then. And then they won't be as good later. And some kids will be, you know, relatively low in the group. And then all of a sudden they'll come on. So you've got to make sure that you give them that opportunity and you don't write them off, really. I think that's where traditionally, you know, we've been really good at the club in identifying players, and players like Tom Cleverley spring to mind. In fact, like Marcus Rashford and Jesse Lingard, they were very small as young players, but and Scott McTominay actually wasn't that big at all. You know, so you've got players that are in the first team now that when they were 8, 9, 10, 11 years old were physically, you know, underdeveloped really compared to some of the other kids, but they had all the other qualities. They had the desire and the work ethic and just the love of the game that we keep talking about. And obviously they were skillful as well. They had lots of ability, but you knew that if they're going to grow. I mean, that's one of the things that frustrates me is how much people in football value the physicality of a young player. So that is massively overvalued in my opinion. Yet the other elements like their work ethic and their love of the game and their decision-making and game understanding, these are things that are so important. And all kids will grow. You know, there's nothing more certain than a 9-year-old kid will grow. And you don't have to be 6'4" to play football. You know, so many of the world's best players are actually about 5'8", 5'9". And there's this obsession, well, he's not big enough. You know, when you hear it all the time of lads getting released because they're not big enough, which is ridiculous when they've got all these other qualities. So we've had many conversations, haven't we, Tony, about players as they come through and saying, well, look, and you have to chat to the parents and say, look, just wait a little bit. And maybe they might even have to play down a little bit and just wait for that time when physically they'll catch up with all the other ability that
I call it the conflict between biological age banding and chronological age, the two different things. So if you're saying under 14 or under 15 in age, you might intellectually or emotionally be older or younger. Mm-hmm. And physically, so you, if you look at, I think probably under 14 is probably around about the age. We've got a row of kids that are under 14, stroke under 15 in a line. Just have a look. Are they all going to be the same size? But also emotionally,
yeah.
And that's the key, emotionally, right? So it's not just physical; it's emotionally, right, and psychologically. So some boys show a real maturity at a young age. So Scott McTominay, you mentioned, was one. Sure. Real maturity, understands the game, understands football, knows what it's about, almost a professional mentality. Mm-hmm. Amazing Greenwood, the opposite. Am I right?
No, you're absolutely right.
And as a coach, you have to be sensitive to that. You have to be sensitive to that, hypersensitive. Your antennae's got to be up. Because if you don't get that bit right, and you're trying to get this kid locked in, and he's just not going to get locked in, you lose him. He's gone.
Yeah.
But that's where you come back to knowing the kids and knowing the players and connecting with them. Because if you've got someone that you know and they are going through a bit of a hard time, whether it's that they're not growing or they've got problems at home and stuff, that if you know the kid and the family that well, then you will be patient with them. But it also goes the other way when if there are certain kids, because programs, you know, Manchester United and other academies, they're very, very high level and you need a lot of commitment to be in them from the whole family. And it's really that the standard is incredible. The kids now, we watch them play, they're absolutely incredible. So it goes the other way, whereas if you've got a lad that's actually struggling and is not performing well, and you start to see his confidence drop and you start to see him getting unhappy, then that's just as important to identify that this isn't the right program for them. And for the benefit of the kid, it may be that you think, well, maybe you might have a chance and blah, blah, blah. But actually, from the club's point of view, it might be better to keep them in the programme. But from that kid's point of view, he needs to go and experience football somewhere else before he loses confidence, before he loses love of the game. So that's where I think it's really key as well to step in, not just with lads that are doing very good and got the potential to play in the first team and in the Premier League, but lads that have got the potential maybe to play semi-pro. Mm-hmm. But if you put too much pressure on them early and make the environment one that they're not successful in, then they'll give up the game and you've lost someone there.
Yeah, and also you've got to be, try and find out what makes the kids tick. Mm-hmm. You know, because I mean, what makes me tick is different to what makes Tom tick or somebody else. But it can't be one size fits all, can it? And there's a famous story about Sir Matt Busby with George Best, you know, a wonderful talent at, you know, 17, 18, 19. And he wasn't doing all the things that the coaching manuals, you know, were supposed to be doing. And I think the coaches were saying, well, what's going on with this kid? And Busby said, no, just leave him alone. Just leave him alone. Mm-hmm. Right? He was that good. You just don't, just let him get on with it. Don't complicate mm-hmm. it. Just leave him alone. And of course, the rest is history.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think coaches, regardless of sport, you know, when people say, oh, yeah, you know, I developed that player. Like, number one, I truly believe that players develop themselves.
Correct.
And coach, you know, and coaches, like, we're more likely to get in the way than help.
I was thinking that as Tony was speaking about leaving people alone. And I was thinking of the lads we've talked about, like Marcus Rashford and Mason Greenwood and Scott McTominay. And I was thinking, I can't remember anything that I ever said to these kids because I remember with Marcus, I used to shake his hand at the start of the session and say, all right, superstar, how are you doing? And he'd go, all right. And that'd be it. And he'd just want to play. There was nothing nothing really that I contributed. All we did was we were there. Like I said before, we were there and we supported them in what they were, what they loved doing. But there was no great words of wisdom that we could say.
John, just recently, over the last 12 or 18 months, people have deemed fit to give me some awards for coaching and this, that, and the other, right? Very, very nice, very, very humble and wonderful, right? And but I'm thinking to myself, I'm not thinking to myself sometimes, hang on. I didn't really coach these kids. It wasn't because of my coaching. Maybe it was because of the environment I created. But in terms of coaching, in terms of teaching them, if they want to be a player, they'll be footballers, and they'll buy, and they'll get to where they want to get to. And if you get in the way, they'll bypass you anyway. They'll bypass you. They'll be that good, right? So, but if you can make it, if you can smooth the way for them, right, make it easier for them, then great. But you know, but they need to be challenged as well, of course. You know, it's not got to be an easy ride. You've got to be disciplined. You've got to give them teach them the basic values of life and discipline at the football club. I think, Tom,
absolutely.
There's a certain way of behaving when you go. One of the things that we do on when we go on tours and tournaments, we've got them sort of 24/7 for a few days or for a week, and you can pack a lot in terms of teaching them about the traditions of the club and values that Tom has mentioned, but also about the country that they're going to and the players that they. In the countries and the famous players of those nations and the history of that particular country. So, for example, we went to Budapest a few years ago, and Puskas, a famous player, I think he scored 83 goals in 85 internationals for Hungary, scored 3 goals in the European Cup final in 1960, the famous 7-3 win against Eintracht Frankfurt. And I think in 1962, the European Cup final in 1962, he scored a hat-trick in the first half against Benfica, and they lost. Can you imagine that? So we go to Budapest, and we're trying to teach our kids about this famous player. Puskas went to his tomb, laid a wreath, laid a pennant. And I think that's important. It's not just about playing the game and going to Budapest and playing in a tournament. We want to know about this footballer. Who was this guy? So it's an education as well, isn't it? You know, and the stadium that we played at, he played at. And so, you know, and obviously teaching young players to make a speech, to thank the people in the restaurant, to thank the hotel for looking after them, making sure they keep the rooms tidy, making sure that they're disciplined because they're representing the club, they're representing themselves, they're representing their families, and they're representing football, right? Yeah. Those are the things. And if you can do that, right, the football really will take care of itself because everybody's qualified. I mean, people have got more qualifications. I've got more qualifications than I know what to do with. It's not maybe a better coach.
Yeah,
I'm hoping that the you know, actually just walking through life has made me a better life coach. I've got a better understanding of young people and what makes them tick. But it's not about coaching sessions. I mean, if coaching sessions made footballers, then I tell you what, I'd be in paradise now. I'd be in Barbados. So I wouldn't be sitting here in sandbags.
Can you imagine, John, that this guy's been my boss for 20 odd years, and that's the message that I've had all the time. And you know, I remember a few years ago we were going to play Liverpool, and I did a little bit of shape work trying to get the team some defensive shape, like 10 under 10s, and I'm getting stick from the sideline. What are you doing? Leave them alone, get them, you know, because I was we were playing Liverpool, and it was, and I was thinking, well, we may have to defend a little bit during this, and we don't want to concede too many soft goals. So I did about 15, 20 minutes of defensive shape with them, and I got loads of stick for it. I got loads of abuse for it. So I think if more, you know, more people had that privilege that I had to have the mentors that I had at United, and obviously Tony's the greatest one, is that then you realise that it's not just about this serious bibs and cones and session plans and computers and all this sort of stuff.
There's time to get your coaching licences and pull them out of the drawer and use them. And there's time to put them back in. And that's the secret. Know when to use that, all that stuff. Know when to use it. But I tell you what, the players aren't interested in how many licences you've got or what level it is, what grade it is. They haven't got a clue, have they? I mean, you think about your best teachers at school. I mean, did you know where they got their degrees? Do you have any clue? Were you interested? Oh. Did you ever ask them? they were more interested in you, were they not?
Exactly.
You know, the good ones made you feel good. And you know something, the good ones made you want to work for them. And the good ones wanted you, made you want to do your best for them. They're the good ones, right?
Yeah.
And they're the ones that, and that's why you remember them. You don't, you know, you, that's the, it make, the memorable. You know, you missed the Wrights, memorable, right? You missed the Lions, memorable.
Mm-hmm.
You missed the Sherwoods, memorable. And then, of course, mm-hmm. other coaches, memorable. Why? Because of that. Because of that, Steve Fleet, a coach, when I was sort of getting onto into the professional side a little bit, and I was coaching, he was at City at the time. I was coaching a little bit on the football and music program, Man City, in the sort of mid-80s. And he literally, I went in to see him, he said, fancy a job, Tony? Yeah, it'd be great. Come down, Steve, I'll do a bit of coaching for you. And it was like, you know, at nighttime, sort of junior clubs, you know, adults, I think, adults, who, you know, these sort of teams, they went and got on some training at night at City's training ground. And I remember Steve said to me, look, Tony, the most important thing that you can give these guys, they've been working all day. When they come down here, they want to have a good time, right? So you've got 10 balls there, 10 balls out, 10 balls in, and between times, make sure they enjoy it. Give them a warm-up, give them a bit of technical work, give them a game for as long as you can, give them a bit of running at the end, and they'll love you.
Mm-hmm.
That's what he said to me, right?
Mm-hmm.
I thought, well, okay, all right, I'll try that. Do you know something? He was absolutely spot on.
Mm.
Honestly, those four mm-hmm. things, that's all he did, right? And really, for the next 25 years, whatever, mm-hmm. that's what I did in various forms.
Mm-hmm.
Just adapted that. That was it. That was it. That was mm-hmm. Those four things, that's what I used to do.
Yeah.
In general. And keep it simple, don't overcomplicate it. At times, of course, if you're playing in a certain tournament, wherever, at the right time, you start doing this, talking about the stuff that he was doing, you know, that he was getting told off for. but not all the time. How much you want to give it? Because you'll turn them off.
Yeah, exactly.
You'll turn them off. I mean, you want to fall asleep. I've fallen asleep in team meetings.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, so,
but there's so many training sessions that you see that where the players just stood still all the time, and it's just a monologue from the coach. The coach is going on and on and on, and the kids are stood there thinking, wow, must be so.
And that's not to denigrate coaching, John, of course. You know,
no.
I've been through the courses. I did the USSF courses.
Yeah.
I was in America, the A and B licenses. I went to Tampa. Yeah. In 1881, I got my B&A licenses, and there's some really superb people there. I learned a lot from the coaching courses and the ones in the UK. So I'm not knocking coaching at all. Yeah. It's does a 9-year-old kid need it? Does a 12-year-old boy need it? I'm not sure. Does a 15-year-old boy need it that much? I'm not sure. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah. Well, I think what you guys talked about, which is really, really critical, is, let me think how to describe this. Well, first of all, I think we might look at a young player and say, oh, look at him. He's talented. But what we're really seeing is his ability. And talent is really ability plus behaviors. And our role as a coach is to instill these behaviors, this respect, pick up your room, these behaviors that will over time lead you to being the best player you're capable of becoming. And what happens is the high ability, low, poor behavior, young kids, oftentimes we let them slide because they have this ability, but then they disappear. And this is where I think a coach, in Holland, they call you trainer coach. They sort of give you two roles, right? And one's the trainer, and that's your licenses and your soccer. And the other piece is the coach, which is the behavior and the connection and the human piece. And you have to use both in your sessions, and you have to really rely on the coaching piece outside of your sessions.
Absolutely. Yes. No.
Really good. Because I say to the kids quite a bit is, I want you to do two things. Number one, I want you to enjoy yourself. And number two, I want you to behave yourself.
Mm-hmm. John,
that's really good.
John, we also have to teach them. I mean, as part of the conversation, it's implicit in the conversation that, life skills are crucial.
Mm.
Hopefully, as coaches, we're teaching young players life skills that they can use well beyond the time that they spent with us, in terms of, how they apply the things that they've learned. So, just a basic thing like hygiene. Mm-hmm. You tell a kid to have a shower, look after his body, make sure you do this, and make sure you do that. And those are things that they'll need anyway. You know, so if you're not disciplined, you're not on time, you're not, you know, you're slacking your work, your quality of your work's not good. When you go to, if you leave football and go into any other walk of life, if you're not doing those things, you're going to have a problem, aren't you?
Yeah.
So yeah. As part of the package, you're not just teaching them football, you're teaching them the other stuff as well.
And especially where you guys work, you know that the percentage of young kids who are going to make it to the, who will make their living and never have to work again a day in their lives because of football is so small that's really, you know, not what you're doing. It's the human development piece to, I mean, Tom, you've told me about kids that you've coached there that you've met running a restaurant or, you know, other stories that remember you. And it's like, you've given them the ability to be a successful human being through football. That's our job. That's coaching.
Absolutely. No question about it.
Yeah. And it's say on my podcast, I've had lads that I coach, you know, they're now in their 30s, the mid 30s, but I coached them when they're young kids. And they do. They come back with, I remember when you said this and I remember when you said that. And it's like, whoa, it's really humbling to think, crikey, you know, 20 odd years ago, I said something to you and you still remember it. That shows you how important your role is.
But that's another important thing though, Tom, that you said there about you better be careful where you tread.
Yeah.
Because those footsteps that you're treading, they can either be, they can be damaging if you're not careful. You know, do you want to stamp out a kid's love of the game? You know, because what you say and what you do and your behavior and your manner as a coach is going to have a massive effect because they don't forget. As emphasized by what Tom just said there, they remember. They remember the little things. They remember them. They really do. Because, you know, players have said to me things, you think, have you remembered that from all those years ago? Mm-hmm. You're thinking, well, if they remember that, there might be other stuff that they remember as well that you might not fancy them ever remembered. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, you know, you have to be very, very careful where you tread and how you tread. Because, you know, we're dealing with very, certainly in our case, working in at the schoolboy level, not so much in the professional phase, that, you know, very, very delicate and precious young people. And I think at the moment, within the professionalisation of the game at a young age is worrying, you know, where you've got professional standards being imposed on young kids when they're not really ready for it because the journey's so long as well. So, you know, in the academy system in the UK, you know, we can register players at under 9. Right, under 9 years of age, onto a contract, and they become commodities because if they want to leave the club and go somewhere else after a few years, there's a fee to be paid, so there's a price on their head. So it raises a lot of issues in terms of human rights or child rights and all sorts of child welfare issues, and the commodification of young players now is quite, I think it's quite serious. Really, in the light of the general discussion that we're having, because that's what's happening. These young kids are not just playing football for its own sake, not for its own sake anymore.
What you're saying, to sum it up, is, you know, instead of, we have to switch our philosophy from maximizing the commodity, right, that we've turned this child into protecting childhood.
Correct.
And that, I mean, that's what this whole conversation has been about. And that is, I think, coaching at any level in any sport, no matter where you are, but especially at your level where, again, kids get turned into a commodity at 8 years old. And it's sad and it's scary.
It's not acceptable, is it?
No, it's not acceptable. Because we wouldn't do that in school. You know, the science teacher couldn't sign the 8-year-old to only do science. So, right.
Yeah. And the other thing is, because young boys are spending so much time now in academies, they don't have time for anything else. Any other childhood experiences. So here's stories about young boys not attending their own birthday party. Mm-hmm. I mean, what? I don't know. I've got my birthday, but I can't go to my party. Well, not great, is it? Because, you know, football, it should be the opposite, you know, obviously.
Well, to be fair on that one, I'm turning 50 in a couple of days and I'm going to be in New York. So my wife and kids said, well, they're going to throw a party without me just so they can make it. So,
wow.
So awesome. Well, hey guys, listen, I want to be respectful of your time and wrap it up. You know, I'll give you, Tom, you first, then Tony, a final thought, a final piece of advice for all the coaches listening here. I mean, I think we've covered incredible ground. I don't have actually any more places to write on my piece of paper. You've said so much great stuff. This has been fantastic. Tom, final thought.
I would just encourage people that are involved with young kids, whether it's football, whether it's other sports, just to realize the role that they're playing in their life and don't take yourself so seriously. You know, don't think you're the next Jose Mourinho or Alex Ferguson or Bill Belichick or something like that. Is just realize that you've got the opportunity to be someone important and someone that is providing fun and joy and pleasure and something really special in some kid's life. And I think that's enough. That should be enough for you to have those experiences and those good times with kids in sport. Then that's exactly what you're doing it for, not for all the other things that you know people think are necessary. It's just have a great time, have a laugh, and you'll create some great memories for yourself.
Yeah, brilliant. Tony.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's all spot on. And I think I just summarize it by saying just you try and do what's in the best interest of the players that you're in, that you're working with at that particular time, and you're honest about that and you're sincere about that, then you're not going to go wrong. Because I think too often we do what's, and I've been guilty of it myself, we do what's we think is in our best interest for whatever reason. But if we can just concentrate on doing what's in their best interest at a particular time, in their best interest, then I think that is the way forward.
Put the child, put the person at the center of it all. Absolutely. Right? Be the architect. Be the architect of the environment.
Yeah, I'm not getting bogged down with the football.
Love it. Guys, this has been, I can't think of a better way to have started my day than with both of you as you're finishing your day. So, thank you so much for being on the podcast here. This has been incredible and what a discussion. We could have kept going on, but I'm going to make it a commitment to get myself over there sometime soon when travel's a little easier to see you both again in person. So thank you so much for being on.
Thank you.
Welcome, John.
All the best, John. Happy birthday to you.
Yeah.
Thanks, guys.
Don't worry about it. I've got about 16 years on you, mate.
Thanks for listening. And if you have a question or comment for us, or if you'd like to take part in one of our podcasts, please email podcast@goplaysoccer.com.